Salad, a podcast for your music business by Creating Vision. MBOL Show.
Trevor,
how are you? All right?
All good. Listen, I must say, we are overjoyed that you have joined us. I am lucky in that I have had the pleasure of gracing the Storm Studios back in the day. The influence we had, you know, you asked us to come in and just do a few little bits.
Well, you guys came up with a couple of really great things. Great loop, right? The loop on Bring It On was great. And we had so many goes at programming the drums for Prayer for the Dying that eventually everybody got it, which is me and Tim. And I said, come on, why the fuck don't we use the loop from Bring It On? I put it in the S1100. And so a lot of the drums are the Dying.
Listen, I'm just glad we were of service. Do you know what I mean? I was glad to be part of the team. Yeah. Bring It On and Prayer for the Dying. Oh, I love that. Listen to that. Mike Carr says, Bring It On and Prayer for the Dying made me a Seal fan from 1994 onwards. It was an amazing time. You guys have obviously just had huge success with Seal. And our thing was that you already had so much good stuff. I remember saying, who was that? You had a huge guitarist on Bring It On. I can't even remember who it was.
A lot of the guitar on that was a guy called Chris Bruce. You know, on Bring It On. But I can't remember because it could have been Wendy as well, you know. They made a demo of it and I kind of elongated the demo and got you guys in and we did that. Bring it on, bring it on.
Is there one Trevor Horn process to making records or are there many different routes?
Well, there are many different routes, but one I generally go down if I'm going to make a record is I learn the song and I play the song and feel it, you know what I mean? Back in the day, you would get a demo, you know? Nowadays, I don't even see such thing as a demo because, you know, all of the means of recording are so good. But yeah, I always try and internalize the song so I know it. And then I can feel what I'm going to do with it. What's the best way? Obviously, it depends who's singing it, you know? You wouldn't do something that would be out of the kind of comfort zone of the singer. But, you know, saying something like that particular Seal track, Bring It On, I made sure that Seal was going into writing with Wendy and Lisa, and I made sure they had a 24-track analog. I said, these are demos on this 24-track analog, and then at least I can transfer it to the Sony afterwards, which is what I did. So that song I wouldn't have learned in the same way. I would have just taken the demo and worked on it. So the thing is, I've done all kinds of records. I've done hip-hop records. I've done kind of big orchestral records. Done all kinds of records. And I think that's the basic thing, learn the song.
It might sound simple. What you're talking about is getting into the bones of the song so you can see it through to its final degree.
Because if you don't get the bones right, you'll have more and more problems down the line, you know? I mean, I'm talking about if you're making singles or if you're working with, like with Seal, where we had a pretty big success, so I wanted to make sure that the album was really good. It can take a while to work out the best way to do a song. Especially if you're making it up as you go along. Seal's material was kind of different to me. I never really heard anything quite like it. And figuring out how to make it, you know what I mean? So how are we going to make it work? So, but what I was going to say, like, you know, some people have, like the people that make all dance records. I haven't just made dance records. Yeah. I have made dance records.
No, I totally get it. You've got to remember, from our point, we hadn't seen anything like it. We walked into some blue building, and what was amazing was you just let us do what we wanted.
Yeah, that's what I wanted.
We just couldn't get out. We were like, what? We thought you were going to come with a whole load of orders. And you were just like, no, just get on with it. I think you walked out of the studio as well, and then you came back in and just went, yeah, okay. And then walked out again and came back in. We were just like, what? But afterwards, I came to understand why you did that.
Well, yeah, I wanted you to feel free to do some stuff without me around it. And if I started to tell you what I wanted was probably, I want to make this track better. I don't know what that will be, you know? And I knew that you would do something.
Yeah.
You know, because I'd heard some of your stuff. I knew you'd do something interesting.
Well, let's keep it moving. Are there three producers, or even two, or even one, that has made you feel, or made you just go, whoa, okay, I need to re-examine what I've just done?
Yeah, well, I could give you a few examples of that, right? Kiss from a Rose. When I finished the record, I wondered if I'd gone too organic with it. And then Adamski did a remix of it called Kicks from a Rose, which I really liked.
Yeah.
And I started to really think maybe I should have gone in that direction with it, you know? So Adamski had some really good ideas, you know, he's a clever guy. I mean, in the end, the record was a big success, so I was okay, but there was a period of time there where I wondered. I really wanted it. I was very impressed with Mark Ronson. I love him and Bruno Mars. It was so cool. And the big horn section and the exciting record with lots of drops and whatever. That kind of struck me. I thought, I should have thought of doing that. That's a really cool, great record. And I think he did it really well. I mean, the record itself was really good. And I suppose the other, and this might be a funny one, but the first time I ever heard NWA, I was kind of like, fuck, man, the lyrics are eye-watering, but the beats, everything, I thought the programming was great. And of course, that was Drake. And he was something else, you know, he still is. If you watch him, especially in the early days when he was doing it with records and stuff, and you see him at the, you know what I mean? There's a famous one that he did. I suppose at the time we had somebody on the label that was trying to do something like that. We'd never really been able to replicate it over here, you know.
You're saying that Dr. Dre's rig was in a way, caught you out.
Well, no, I'm actually all in favor of good, simple rigs. You don't need too many things. But he had a couple of things that I got, like MPC. I think he was using Radar at the time. And he had a youth. I don't know if you've seen that studio record one. It has the most incredible wall of monitors, you know, speakers. It's like definitely Alan Sides owns it, the guy that used to own Ocean Way.
So, with Yes, the band's there's all sorts with this. Firstly, the band's name was Cinema, right?
Yeah.
Secondly, John Anderson was the Yes frontman that you had replaced.
Yes, I was only actually the singer in Yes for a year. You know, I sang on one album and did two tours. And then that band stopped, really, because I wasn't good enough. And I went off and went into production. And so I was sort of intrigued by Trevor Rabin. He was a new addition. And then when I heard Owner of a Lonely Heart, I thought this could really work. I could get them a hit single, you know.
Well, you did more than that. Band's name Cinema. John Anderson is Yes frontman, who you had replaced for a short time. You had to convince them about the song. You also had to convince them to rewrite a section.
Yeah, well, that's what you do when you're a producer. You're not really meant. You're meant to make the best record you can. And I was lucky to be such good friends with them because I'd been in the band, so I could really emotionally blackmail them, you know, to get them to do it, because I thought it would be really good for them to do Owner of a Lonely Heart, you know.
But there is a thing here, right? And it's this thing of the people that have to convince the stars to do something that they can't see at the time.
Yeah, well, there's a long history of that, you know. That famously Dave Robinson once told me that you know, Madness used to do It Must Be Love in their stage act. And he said, I want to record that. You've got to record it. And they didn't want to. Then he said, if it
if you record it and it doesn't get to number one, I'll give you your back catalogue back. That's what it did get to number one. It's sometimes it's just called desperation. You know, it was such a great chorus, but the verse was so wrong, and you know the tune was wrong in the verse as well, because it was a bluesy tune, and it really needed a more yesy tune, but you know, I have to say Trevor Rabin was a real great guy to work with. We had a lot of fun, even though we argued a lot of times. I was very fond of him, you know. And the playing on that whole album, you know, if you're into rock bands, is great, you know. Those are the days when you played it, you know.
You say music is like seeing emotions, right? Mm. Can you explain a bit more about what that means?
Well, you know, we all live in a kind of normal world. We get up in the morning and we do things. Music, certain kinds of music, just make you kind of see another world, like maybe an expansive, more beautiful, more countryside world, or all kinds of worlds you can see in music, and they can shift your mood. Debussy said, "Music doesn't portray emotions; it is the emotion," which I've kind of never quite understood. But all the music I liked, I used to listen to it because it made me. It took me out of myself and did something to me that made the day seem better, I guess.
I've got another question here. Buggles, video killed the radio star. I'm going off of a rumor here. So the rumor is that you spent nearly the whole album's budget on that one song. Is that true?
More or less true. They gave us kind of like a budget of 10 grand to do 5 songs. And about sort of 4 weeks later, they said, "How are you getting on?" And I said, "Well, we've kind of just scrapped the last 2 weeks of work. We're starting again with Video Killed the Radio Star." Because you've gone through the 10 grand budget, you know. And we were like, "Yeah, well, we're starting again." They said, "Why are you starting again? And you haven't done the other things?" And you say, "Yeah, well, we got it okay, but we wanted to get to number one. We were so arrogant, not arrogant, but we were so crazy." So yes, we spent most of the album budget just on Video Killed the Radio Star, but it was worth it, you know.
Okay, so my thing goes, we were in the downstairs, you won't remember this. We were in the downstairs kitchen at Somme, which always served really good food, by the way. But we were in this downstairs kitchen and I turned to you. And by the way, this is something that you said was stuck with me, because you were explaining how many times you had taken crazy back and forth to the masters, as in it's finished. No, it's not. As in, it's finished. No, it's not. As in, it's finished. No, it's not. And you were explaining it. And I said, "Trevor," I said, "how do you know?" And you know, your reply was, "Kwame," you said, "you always know."
All right.
Now, taking it to this, the video killed the radio star.
Yeah.
You're like, this whole thing of, do you know what? We've got it, but we think we can make it even better. We think we can make it. Because obviously at the time, you had... there was another version of the song already out.
No. The other version, which was done by the other writer, Bruce Woolley, came out with Camera Club, but it came out the same time as ours. But thing was that we did a great demo of Video Killed the Radio Star. It was really good. It was almost like the record for like the first 2.5 minutes. And then the end of the record's better. But when we got the money, we couldn't use that demo. To use that demo would have meant signing a contract with somebody that we didn't want to sign a contract with.
Right.
So we had to start again. And the first time we started again, we improved it so much that after 2 weeks, it was a piece of shit. Right? You know what I mean? We just hadn't been careful enough to copy the demo. So we went back. I'll never forget, Jeff and I were listening to it in his place. The version that we scrapped, and we were both going, yeah. And then we looked at each other and went, start again. This was probably after 2.5 weeks. That version had got a long way out. I'd be curious to find it. So we started again. And this time we got the same drummer we got that had played on the demo. And we really, like, you know, we played that backing track, piano, bass, drums, for 14 hours. We finally got it at about sort of 3:30 in the morning with the drummer being really cross. I was playing this triple session thing. Because he had to play it perfectly. That was why we went through most of the budget. We didn't make the same mistake again. We copied the demo absolutely, everything about it. I even bought back the AC-30 that I'd sung the demo through in the first place, you know? So it taught me a very, very good lesson that if you've got a really great demo, you can't afford to change anything on it, you know, or lose any of the magic.
Now we're getting into some kind of, okay, so
yeah,
this no to a yes thing. Have you got any other no's where literally you're just like, 1 minute it looks like it feels the bar back, and then the next minute you're just like, actually, we've got it?
Well, I would say that maybe Slave to the Rhythm was probably one of the best things of that, because, you know, we'd done this sort of marching version of it, and I hated it. I had this idea of doing it over a go-go beat, but when we got the band in the studio, we were kind of getting nowhere. But we had like 16 bars of the drummer just jamming, you know, Juju, as they was. And he was playing this great beat. And we were playing these 16 bars. And Bruce Woolley had we had a JX8P. And Bruce Woolley played those chords over that beat. Jam, jam. That was like, wow, that's the way to go with this one, you know?
Right.
It's okay. That marching band thing. So that was a moment like that. It looked hopeless, and suddenly it looked fantastic. I mean, it took us a while to convince everybody because they were used to the Sleep to the Rhythm. I just didn't like that much.
All right, so video killed the radio star. Has AI killed the recorded music star? What do you think about AI?
Well, I could be terrified of it if I got carried away, but I mean, there's probably a good gag in it if you want to, you know. I was thinking about it the other day, but you know, I know it can change voices. You can sort of, you know, you can sing something and then you can change yourself into Frank Sinatra, right? I've seen some examples, but the examples I've seen were like, it was like Kendrick Lamar, and someone was doing a rap that was like a Kendrick Lamar thing, and then they would make him sound like Kendrick Lamar. But it's, you know, you can change your voice quality, but so much of the way somebody sings is in the phrasing, in the register that they sing in, and what they sing, and what they're singing over. It's no good getting Frank Sinatra to sing Smoke on the Water, you know?
Okay. Okay. Gary Langham, Tim Widener, obviously you've got a host of other people that have, like, you know, gone on to do incredible things, but have all been... Tom Elmhurst, I think, right?
Gary Langham was terrific. I mean, Gary used to, you know, back in the day, Psalm Studios, you know, when I first started working there, Gary was the engineer there. Once I started having a few hits, we couldn't get into Psalm East anymore. And so I had to go to other studios, and I took Gary with me. And Jill's father, David, was so angry with me. You're taking the best engineer. And Jill had to explain to him, that's the way it works now. Engineers stick with producers. And Gary and I went, you know, when we were doing ABC, David Bowie's studio, we were all over the place, you know. And then we would end up back at Sam, you know, the days. But Gary was brilliant. He would do stuff that would, you know, I would be amazed by. Can we do that? Can we get away with that? Wow, you know, that much reverb. It was an exciting time for gear. That's the thing, you see, because there was new stuff coming out all the time.
Trevor, don't you find that, like, when a new piece of kit comes out,
yeah,
and there's a time at the beginning when it's all kind of experimental, or people are using factory settings for things that just sound good. And it's this thing of there's a real exploration time before people, almost before people get into the real bones of something. And then there's a time where everybody gets onto this gear, and then everybody's records almost begin to sound similar. It's almost as though you've got to be in the first leap.
No, you're right, because back in the day we had, you know, when I was working with Steve, when I first started working with him, you know, we had a whole Oberheim rig, a DMX, a DSX, and an Oberheim synthesizer that I'd used with the world's famous Supreme team on Buffalo Girls. And linked to that, you know, we were using Octave Plateau Voyager sequencer. We had a Lin drum machine as well. And there was, and we had Page R in the Fairlight. So we had all of these things, and we linked them all with a thing called the conductor that linked them all, that made it so they all worked together. It was a bit shaky, but it did work. Yeah, that's how we did things like talk to Mabusa and whatever. But even before that, my first rig was a TR-808, a mini loop, a CVM gate, and a Roland sequencer that you just put lists of notes into, and it gave out CVM gate. And I triggered the Roland sequencer from Dave Simmons, put me a load of triggers on the TR-808, and I had some of his drums, Simmons drums. And I triggered those and the mini Moog from the cowbell on the so, you know, for instance, I programmed first ABC track, I programmed the drum part into the 808, and then drove the Simmons drums with it, and I programmed the whole bass part. I mean, taking from what they played, you know, and then it was like making a grid, you know. I mean, TR-808 was so laborious to program. I couldn't do it now. I'd have to write everything down, you know. It took me about 8 hours, and then we printed it on tape, and they played on top of it. But recording's a really interesting thing, and if you work at it, you can get quite, you know, the difference between them just playing that track to a click, and then them playing over a very precise version of it, made it sound a lot more like Chic.
Right, okay. Just before I carry on with the interview, I want to take a minute to talk about a great company called Fable. They are creative music marketing legends. They come up with the most brilliant original ideas to promote artists and releases by creating really cool stuff that actually happens everywhere. Fable was set up by a guy who is an ex-recording artist and music producer, someone with over 30 years' experience in the music industry, so they know what they're doing. The stuff that they do gives you exciting, cool-looking content, and you get people engaged in real-world activities. People stop and want to know what's going on. The way that I look at them is they are creative solutions for maximum artist visibility. And no, I don't have a stake in the company, but they are bloody good at what they do. So check them out, fable.co.uk. That's fable.co.uk. Anyway, on with the interview. Keith Law has written, when a new producer breaks the rules, do you ever think, oh, please don't break that particular rule?
The main rule for me that's worth obeying is keep the record entertaining. There's a lot of people doing acoustic versions of old tunes now. You know, I've just done a few. It can be good. It can also not be so good here, but it can be a bit boring. All right for a verse and a chorus, but you know, a really good record builds up a momentum as it goes along. It's like getting on a ride, you know, and you go to the end rather than hopping off because, you know, well, it's just Colin Morley's coming and nothing else, you know.
I put here, I disagree with you on the name The Buggles. I actually think it was a good name. I put, discuss, how important is a name?
Oh, I think a name's very important. And I was always a bit stupid with that kind of thing, because the idea of The Buggles is almost like the idea of AI. You know, like in 78, we had this, Bruce Willey and I talked about this idea of a guy in a basement with a computer making pop records on the computer and making up the band as well. And you could do that now with AI. And one of the bands, which was a sort of ripoff of the Beatles, was the Buggles. And the record that the AI made with it was Video Killed the Radio Star. That was the idea. Initially, we weren't going to appear. I suppose it was maybe a bit more like Gorillaz, but when you suddenly get a record that was so popular, we were on island, you know. It was funny because we were there in our silver suits, and you had, you know, Burning Spear, I think, and all those guys, all the radio guys.
Okay. So your favorite drum machine?
My favorite drum machine?
Yeah, your favorite drum machine, sir.
Tonight, the MPCs. I've got one right to hand here. MPC Live, yeah, it's great. You can knock anything up in a second. It's an MPC Live, but I've got old ones as well. You know, I think the dance guys liked it because it had a swing to it. It was great. But I think I used a DMX on Buffalo Girls back then, yeah, because I could link it to the sequencer.
Let me keep it moving. So, simple things done well. This is a quote that it is in your book, Simple Things Done Well. So why is that so hard? I put here, do you consider ABC's All of My Heart to be a simple thing done well?
Simple Thing Done Well was something that Tina Charles said to me one time when I was living with her. She said, I was playing in a jazz rock outfit that became Shack Attack. It wasn't called Shack Attack when I was in it. And she said to me, I don't know why you try and play this jazz rock. You'll never play as well as Stanley Clarke. Why don't you just try and play simple things properly? Especially when I started making records, the bass is always going to be a bit simpler than you think, you know? All of My Heart, the fun thing about All of My Heart was that when it started out, Anne played it on the piano, and I got it to track the piano with a Fender Rhodes. We spent quite a bit of time getting the sound right. So everything she plays on the piano is tracked with the Rhodes. And on top of that, I think we also put a few things like, what's it called? Not Vibes. The other one, Xylophone, Glockenspiel. But all playing the same thing, you know?
How long? Because Anne appears again, Dudley appears again. And again and again in your work. How long were you with her?
We worked together for a long time. Anne is great because, you know, especially since sometimes I had no real idea of what I was doing. Anne would come up with something. And if I said, oh, I like that, that's a good idea, she would just write it down so she could remember it. Other people would go, oh, I can't remember what I played. But Anne wasn't like that. No, Anne had really good chops. She could just play stuff. She could also solo really well. When we were working with the famous Supreme team doing all those rap and scratching things, and you could, at one point, one of them says, "Hey, Anne, play the organ, Anne. Come on, Anne, play the organ."
Yeah.
Anne plays this beautiful piano solo. Because, you know, she was a lovely, lovely player. You could just say, Anne, music.
Yeah.
She do something, you know?
You would just do it. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So we've got some more here. There's all sorts of... Joe Craven has asked, how do you keep motivated and on track in a session? What keeps your mind from wandering?
Well, my mind does wander. My mind does wander. Well, you know, our minds wander. But how do I keep... I get my head between the speakers. These days, it's a lot of workstation work, one thing at a time, you know, to make sure that the basic thing's right. And then you're kind of, if you bring a musician in, it's one musician, you know. Back in the day, I would start off with three or four musicians and sort of routine a track like that, you know, before I actually started programming anything. Sometimes getting everybody to play it was a good way to find the arrangement, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Your favorite productions that weren't you, but sounded like you?
In the 80s, it was probably a bit more like that. I always liked you know, there's a couple of Bucks Fizz records, like the Land of Make Believe.
Land of Make Believe.
Which had a sort of very, very dominant drum track that I felt like, yeah, it sounds a bit like, kind of a bit like me, but not, you know, it was Andy, well, anyway, the guy that Norman produced it. I can't, you know, can't remember many others because I suppose the trouble is when you do something and that's the way you do it, you don't really hear it much in other people's. I mean, I hear lots of the devices that I used, you know, the arrangements, you know, all the, but I, anything I used, well, all of my tricks that I used to use in the 12 inches, I got from listening to dub reggae in the 70s because that was way, you know, like the double drop, you know, double drop it down and then drop it even more. Just this. And then how you build it back up again and then give it a bit of a smash, you know, all those kind of things.
Yeah.
So I was living in a place with an Australian guy who had every dub reggae record going and played them all day. And so I listened to a lot of that, you know. And so what I'm trying to say is I nicked it from somewhere else. So I, how could I complain if people nick stuff from me? I mean, after that drum fill on Poison Arrow, well, that was a Simmons set of Simmons drum pads, which is synthetic drums, through a Marshall stack. Then, you know, with like the EMT crash box on them and double tracked, you know, actually played, not programmed or anything, you know. That's why they sound so big, you know, kind of.
Okay, so I've got South Africa. Obviously, back then, you've gone over to America with Malcolm McLaren, and then you've ended up in South Africa. Are there any sort of South African act from then through to now that you've just gone to yourself, wow?
Well, we were there 2 years before Paul Simon, but it was still apartheid. That was a strange experience. I spent 19 nights. We could only get the studio at night. So we started at 8 in the evening and finished at 8 in the morning for 19 nights. But we were all locked in because I had like 16 musicians with me, assorted Kosas and Zulus. I think the three ladies were Zulu ladies because that's that thing at the start of Buffalo Girls is a... is what they do when they're going to kill somebody.
Yeah.
She told me, hey, Gemma, I got this thing. This is what we do. We're going to kill somebody. I really liked it. We had a lot of fun. We did the skip, we do the double dutch and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And just a really nice night. It was a guy called Big Voice Jack. Boom, 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 boom. Wake him up. I'd wake people up. Go on, Jack. It's your go. You know what I mean? On one of the days off that we had, Malcolm drove me and Gary out to Soweto. There was no electricity. It was kind of frightening. So, you know, it was a strange place. And when we finished, we paid it. We paid all the musicians. I think we gave them like 1,500 quid each, right?
Okay, it's a massive amount.
It was huge.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we're almost done. The one question I want to go back over, like rock staple, incredible chorus. The story goes, you recognized it from an early point. As a big song. In fact, I think it's right in saying that song was the reason for you doing the album.
Well, that song made me think I could get this to work. You know, I didn't want to do a Yes album and not have a kind of hit single. And I only heard Owner of a Lonely Heart because Trevor was playing me some songs on a quarter inch tape. Trevor went to the loo and the tape kept going and the demo of Owner of Lonely Heart came on. And what really intrigued me to kick off with was it had this big da 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 and then it cut straight into boom, boom, boom. That was on Trevor's demo. But the big sort of dang da 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 bits were actually just a mini moog.
Yeah.
And the verse was awful, but the chorus was great. They hit the chorus. Trevor just walked in and said, oh, that song's not for Yes. And I said, you're kidding. That's a number one for Yes. That, you know, that was early days. It took a long time from that. You know, the record was getting good, but we couldn't we couldn't seem to finish the songs. And, you know, I knew that there was something missing. And I thought that it should be Yes again, and that would make it obvious, and we should get John in because he's a terrific singer. And you see, at that point, the guy that was sort of running the band was Chris Squire, you know, the bass player. And I think he knew I was right, because I couldn't see how we had these great things, you know, we had these great tracks, but they needed to be finished, and it needed to be in a commercial vehicle, you know.
All right, listen, we managed to get it done. Trevor, you have been a wonderful, wonderful person for the MBOL show.
Good, bro. I hope you enjoyed it.
I did. And, you know, I know there's people coming in, there's people sort of saying, listen, thank you so much for your time. And also, thank you for my experience on that one there.
Okay, that one there. I remember.
No, that's all I can say.
Okay, you should come to one of the shows in England in September.
Oh, don't worry. The invitation is taken. Don't worry, I'll be there.
Great.
Music Business Online, a podcast for your music business by Creating Vision. MBOL Show.